Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Seth with SethPerlow.com and the Executive Function Online Summit. So I'm glad to have you back. I'm here with Carly Rae Ellingson. And Carly Rae is an educator, a body worker, a mindfulness-based wellness educator. Don't worry if you don't know what that means. This is a really awesome topic we're covering today. She's a personal trainer and a founding director of a school that helps students who struggle in public school. So they really work with a neurodiverse population, a population of kids that really thinks and processes information differently. So that's what their specialty is. And Carly Rae works with Zach Morris, who's another person that we have on the summit. So they work closely together, but she's going to come from a completely different angle than Zach did in our interview today. And today she's going to talk about how neurosensory, and excuse me if I botch this, Carly Rae, but how neurosensory functions impact executive function, and how when we're thinking about executive function, and what Carly's going to talk about is how before you even start addressing executive function, you have to understand some things that are going on with the body that we often don't talk about. And then we're going to talk about how trauma impacts us and what to do about that. Now, parents who are watching right now, I want you to know that if you think, oh, well, there's no trauma in our family, or I want you to have an open mind to what how broad the definition can be and how impactful it is, because I see it in my practice in so many ways. So it may not be what you think. I think a lot of times people catastrophize trauma and think of it as that it had to be a giant traumatic event when it's not necessarily that. So we're going to get into that today. I do think this is a very important topic that I'm not sure that anybody else on the summit is covering in this kind of a way. So I think it's really important. The reason I think this is so important is because in our culture, and Carly Rae and I were talking a little bit about this before we started today, but in our culture, we don't talk a lot about what's going on in the body. We tend to be very heady, very mind-focused, very thought-focused, and we tend to be pretty oblivious. Now, the problem with that is that it has a tremendous impact on our lives. So when we're oblivious to it and it has an impact on our life, we're missing out on having more agency and control over what's going on in our life. So hello, Carly Rae. How are you doing today?
I'm well, thanks, Seth.
So there's a little intro. And from your perspective, tell us what we're going to learn today for a parent who has never heard of some of the concepts.
Today we're going to talk about how we can understand what is coined as neurosensory development, or how our sensory system, or how we intake and input information from the world, affects how we behave. I want to help people understand how social behavioral histories can provide us information about neurosensory functioning and in the other direction. I also want to help facilitators and parents kind of shift the lens through which we look at behavior, so that we can have just like a really compassionate, heart open understanding of the underlying functions that are happening at the biological, physiological level that often manifest in behavior that is then often kind of judged as bad or undesirable or naughty or dysfunctional, and kind of help people understand that that behavior is more of a message for us to be looking at what is going on under the hood, if you will.
Awesome. Awesome. So for the parent that's watching and that's going, wow, what the heck did you just say? And what parent watching should continue watching today? Like a parent who's concerned about what? One thing that you said was a parent who has a child who's behaving badly. Right. What kind of parent will this really benefit today?
I think the parents who are feeling a little bit frustrated with the messages that they're receiving from teachers and other facilitators, where I've heard some parents say, at home, he never acts like this, but then I hear all of these things happening at school. Or the parent who has maybe been to this, that, and the other specialist, trying to improve math or reading scores, and they're not finding the success that they're kind of wanting. You mentioned the the parents that are like, oh, I don't really have any trauma in our life. Trauma can come from a hard roller coaster ride. Basically what happens in...
Let's dive into the details of that in a bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think that was perfect, what you just said, for the parents who should be watching. Anything else you want to add about that before we, because I want to get into trauma deeper later.
Everyone, really, because we all have nervous systems, and we all have behaviors that sometimes we don't understand why we're behaving in this way. And there is a lot of really incredible research coming out in the last few years in regards to how our nervous systems function and how that relates to how we cope with our world.
Cool. Parents, I know for a lot of you, you haven't heard of a lot of these terms, because when I started going down these rabbit holes with the nervous system and such, it was so new to me and so out there. And I really want you to sit tight for this one as we unpack this. I told Carly before, I'm going to be asking a lot of follow-up questions on this. So please stick around on this. So tell parents who you are personally. Forget work. What are you into? What makes Carly Carly? What do you do for fun?
Well, my bodywork practice really is more of a hobby than work for me. I really think that there's a beautiful connection that is established when you get to work with people one-on-one and teach them about their bodies. I am a Montanan, born and raised, very lucky to have the backdrop of my life be the Swan Mountains and Flathead Lake. I love the outdoors, and I personally got into this work because I was in a really traumatic car accident when I was 20 years old. And that schwacked my nervous system, my vestibular functioning, all those things. And my rehabilitation back to having all of my organs be repaired and the bones that were broken and the way that my structure changed, totally led me down this rabbit hole of understanding the nervous system and how your central nervous system and your peripheral nervous system interact with each other to help you function in the world. I'm super passionate about helping young people. I think that now, out of any time in history, it is so important for us to be supporting young people and giving them the skills to help digest life and to help cope and understand with the world around them. It's increasingly complex. I'm a person. I have my own executive functioning difficulties that I have had to implement strategies and tools for over the years. And I just am so excited to be a part of this with you, Seth. And
cool.
Started Learn Inc. As a mechanism of seeing a need,
Let's transition to that. So my next question was going to be, professionally, who are you? What do you want us to know about your professional career? And can I ask, before you get into that, did your car accident impact your executive function?
Yeah, it did.
Okay. You can tell us about it later if you want, okay. But I was just curious. So, and then professionally?
We just entered our 7th year of Learning Pursuits with Learn Incorporated, and it is a school for whole person learning. We look through the pillars of a nonviolent communication curriculum that was coined by Dr. Marshall Rosenberg.
Parents who haven't heard of the nonviolent communication, it's really influenced a lot of professionals particularly in the therapy world today, is that correct?
Yeah.
So you can research that. It is a really cool concept that I think can influence you families out there that are watching if you want to go down that rabbit hole. Sorry to interrupt you, Carly Rae.
Absolutely. And then we look at, more ecological literacy, more systems thinking, kind of Socratic style learning. It's all very student driven and it's all individualized. And it's also kind of based on trauma-informed care. Sometimes the students have come to us being fairly traumatized by their previous learning experience. And so that's a whole different approach. Rather than just hitting the books right away, it's more about establishing safety and relationship, and then helping the student kind of uncover what their needs are and how they're going to communicate themselves in the world to get those needs met.
Cool. One of the cool things about this summit is that people keep saying the same things in different ways. And you were talking about under the hood. I talk about iceberg theory and how we often see the tip of the iceberg. So, for example, the student that's had a lot of trauma, they may be acting out or their grades may be falling, whatever. But there's all this stuff underneath the tip of the iceberg that we need to look at, and we get to see how you explain that today from your perspective. But one of the things that you just mentioned that I've heard from almost every speaker is about relationship and safety. And that's just so cool to hear this theme come up again, because it's everything.
Yeah, really important.
Anything else you want us to know about your professional background?
I also work with adults. I do mindfulness-based wellness education. I have a bodywork practice. I work with traumatized people to help them recalibrate to their own body, to their environment. I am really interested in the polyvagal stuff coming from Stephen Porges and Peter Levine.
I know a little bit about that. Are we going to get into that today? I would like to.
We can. A little bit, yeah. And I'll have some in my resources, actually. And then there's also a really great podcast called the Polyvagal Podcast. It's by Justin Sinceri, and he is a LMFT, a family marriage counselor, and he distills it down to really approachable language.
Okay, cool.
And I recommend his podcast.
Okay, I am very interested in that, sort of for me, next level. So what is your superpower as far as working with a student?
Ooh, my superpower as far as working with a student is being able to hold the energetic space, and to also have a really acute awareness of the signs of stress that student might be experiencing. Because one of the other philosophies that we work with is a modality called Handle, developed by a woman named Judith Bluestone. And she says that, you know, the stressed system doesn't learn efficiently. And that there are very subtle signs of stress before shutdown happens, before we reach breakdown. We can actually see if the student is feeling stressed before they even really have an awareness of their own level of stress. Mm-hmm. And so there are some cues and some things to look at physiologically in the body.
Cool. So I really relate, you know, like I said, a lot of the concepts we hear from different speakers are similar concepts, just with different words around them. And what I hear a lot about what you're saying right now is attunement. And I think for parents watching, one of the problems with attuning to very subtle differences that are going on in your child's nervous system is that when parents often are dealing with the struggles that the students are having, parents often are becoming dysregulated.
Yeah.
And aren't necessarily very aware of their own dysregulation and how our nervous systems are always sort of communicating to each other. We have our words that we communicate, but our nervous systems are vibing off of each other. And we're sort of constantly saying things to ourselves like, I should be scared right now. Okay, well, then let's both be scared together and figure out what the threat, yeah. You know, like our nervous systems are sort of having these dialogues while we're trying to use logic to communicate a concept to our kid when we're concerned. So learn what I hear is that attunement, that learning to, for adults, how important it is to learn to regulate themselves and then be attuned to these subtle things that we may not even normally notice because we're so in our heads and in the story and in the logic and how to rationally deal with the problem at hand, a given problem at hand.
So they talk about that in the polyvagal theory in regards to being pulled down the polyvagal ladder. And so the vagus nerves is one of the primary cranial nerves, and it connects, or innervates is the scientific word. It connects into our facial expression. It connects into the motor pathway to our limbs. It also connects into our gut. And what we basically say is that we have safe and social. We have flee, we have fight, and then we have freeze or shutdown.
Okay, and so hold on, let me interrupt you here. So when you said cranial, the vagus nerve or the vagal nerve is in the cranium somewhere?
Yep.
And when the relevance of you telling us that it has to do with facial muscles and stuff is because of the subtle express or not so subtle expressions we make to express?
Yeah.
And so, same with you said this, the gut responds as well.
Well, and so as we move down the polyvagal ladder, essentially what we say, so we have the lion is chasing us, right? And we move our, we physiologically are primed to different places through that vagus nerve. And so we're priming to fight, or we're priming to run. And
so if the lion is chasing us, the vagus nerve is very important in that process of noticing that there's a threat and knowing how to instruct the body for how to respond to a threat.
Right. Right. And so we kind of go in levels, right? So safe and social isn't a place to be with the lion, right? And so then we move down to.
So I'm so sorry to, I'm going to interrupt you so much though, but safe and social is a place where our nervous system is pretty, would you say is pretty regulated?
Yeah.
We're in a calm place. If you're on a scale of 1 to 10, you're sort of at a 1 or a 2 in safe and social.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just trying to put this together in my own mind for models that I've used, and then also just unpack it for the parents a little bit. So I told her I was going to ask a lot of these. I'm not trying to be annoying, but this is really a lot to unpack here, a lot of layers. So we have the safe and social, and that's considered by practitioners as being sort of a top level safe place. Okay, let's go, yeah. Go ahead.
And so one of those other place, you know, if we can't be safe and social, then we move into, well, maybe I need to flee. And if I can't flee, then I need to fight. And if I can't fight, then I shut down. Right. And that shutdown place, most other mammals can move in and out of that shutdown space quite easily. Humans don't have quite as much ease moving in and out of that shutdown space, or in and out of that primed, ready to fight, ready to flee space. And a lot of times what happens is because of our environment or the expectation of the classroom or the people around us, we don't have the opportunity to discharge that stress response.
Is that the Peter Levine word?
Yeah, I actually got that from, I can't think of her name right now. But essentially what we're saying is like physiologically our nervous system gets primed to do those things, but then we don't actually have the chance to do those things. And that's where the excitement of arousal gets coupled with fear, and that's where trauma occurs, is we don't uncouple that arousement from that fear.
Okay.
Arousal.
Okay. Awesome. So I'll put this sort of through my filter and unpack it a little bit more. So you have a student and they're in a social situation, or they're in a classroom. Let's say they're in a classroom and they're feeling some stress. It could be because of a social situation. It could be because they didn't do their homework. Could be because they don't want to be there. They're bored and they're getting frustrated. I want to really make this clear to parents that some students will, their frustration will show externally, and some it won't at all. They can be looking totally calm. In fact, watching me right now, I may be totally stressed out right now and thinking about my next interview, which I'm not. I'm present with you, but a lot of times I think it's what you mentioned earlier is how you said your superpower was sort of attuning or understanding these subtle things that you're seeing going on in their nervous system that we often miss. But our nervous system, with the kids in the classroom, they're having some situation we may not even know about, and their body is having a response. So they're not in the safe and social zone anymore, which is a prime learning zone, a good place for your brain to be if you want a kid to be learning. So they start moving into the fight, flight, freeze type zones. Their nervous system is having an experience, and they're not able to discharge. So what that means is that most animals can go through a traumatic experience and sort of discharge it, let the experience that they just had sort of do its thing and be done with it and move on. Whereas one of the things about us humans and our complicated minds and the story in our minds and what's and the situations we're being in, especially if we feel trapped in a situation like a classroom, to feel trapped and our nervous system feels it, even if the kid looks like they're not experiencing anything, their body is experiencing this a sense of fear and fight, flight, or freeze, but it's getting kind of stuck. It's not able to discharge.
Yeah. So for instance, if they're being physiologically primed to fight, but then they don't actually have the opportunity to bat their wings or if they're being physiologically primed to run and they don't have the opportunity to actually run away.
And it's like sit in your seat or.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Or you're in detention or timeout or.
Yeah. And so when I talk to kids, I think about what are ways to discharge that stress response, right? We can, if we look at how the animal kingdom does it, like when you see two birds maybe getting into it and then they separate from each other and they flap their wings, right? They're discharging all of that physiological priming that was happening. A dog will shake, right? A really traumatized dog will kind of chatter his jaw a little bit. And that's that trembling. That's that like release of that physiological priming. Another way is making noise, right? So yelling or singing is a way to kind of reverberate some of that out of the system. Another way is movement of any kind. Exercise, dancing, running, connecting with people, feeling reassured, having someone who is in a safe and social place not get pulled down that polyvagal ladder with you as you're going there. You kind of spoke earlier about parents supporting their kids and you guys are kind of both in a dysregulated place. Like Justin Sinceri talks about co-regulation and how our culture is kind of obsessed with this idea of self-regulation and leaving the child alone to self-regulate, and how damaging that actually is. Because in those primitive understandings of a being, we're never left alone. You know, this idea of co-regulation or the ability to model being in a regulated state while this little person is in a dysregulated state is so important, and it is a prerequisite for self-regulation. Mm-hmm. We can't.
Well, they're looking to us as a caregiver, at least their nervous system, or as a mammal, they're looking to us as these adult beings who are teaching us how to live in the world. And when they can look to us and see, oh, I feel really uncomfortable in my body, but my caretaker is telling me that we are safe. Right. It allows their nervous system. And I think it even connects to the dog. Like if we have our own dog and our dog is, we were at the dog park and our dog has just got chased by a mean dog and we're sitting in the car and our dog's teeth are chattering, what are we going to do? We're going to be like, it's okay. You know? Yeah. So in that context, humans were like, okay, yeah, it's okay to pet the dog and hold the dog and be like, you're going to be okay. But somehow we've learned in culture, yeah, like you're saying about sort of the self implications of self-regulation, and but we need each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry. I'm going to interrupt you so much. Okay. So where were you going?
So what I want to kind of shift into is how we can see signs of stress.
Great.
What are the subtleties to us being the teacher, the facilitator, the adult? How can we tell that maybe there's a little bit of stress happening in the system so that we can know that, you know, further nudging might send us towards tantrum or shutdown, right? Or how can, what's happening in the student that's telling us that their nervous system isn't feeling quite regulated and ready for learning and ready to tackle those executive functioning tasks.
Okay.
The first one of those being,
can I ask a question? When you first, I think Zach was telling me, when you first get students at your school, your first objective is to sort of get them to know that they're in that, say, not necessarily safe and social mindset, but a safe and social environment.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That is correct.
I just think
takes a while to get them to feel regulated to their environment.
Mm-hmm. And then you have to be attuned. Okay. So how do we start that?
So the first signs are kind of like changes in muscle tone or a reddening of the face or the ears. You can see this happening when a student is involved in a task that they have not integrated. They're not quite finding success in said task yet. That they'll get like a little reddening of their ears, or maybe they'll change color in their face. And that's a primary sign that their resources are starting to go elsewhere in the body, right? Their attentional priorities are changing away from the task and towards regulating the body system.
So as they're starting to go away from here and get into the three, is there three lower?
There's safe and social, flee, fight, freeze.
Okay, so as they're sort of going into there, that we'll notice a change. Well, you might notice a change in the color. And so for you, who's very attuned to this and done this a lot, is it, I feel like that's something I wouldn't notice consciously very well. Is there a way that me or parents, is it just a matter of looking for it several times?
I think it's just a matter of understanding what those signs are, and then, yeah, attuning to your student a little bit more intensively so that you can start to notice that they're losing mastery of the task at hand.
Got it. Okay.
Other things are a change in breath rate or breath pattern.
Do you want to talk about the musculature? You said something about that.
So a change in muscle tone a little bit. If all of a sudden they lose their posture, or if they start to clench, you know, if they get their furrowed brow, those kinds of things, we can see that they're maybe starting to feel a little bit uncomfortable in their seat. If they start to get wiggly, or they start to tap their pencil, or, you know, like that's all of those things we kind of as adults are annoyed by some of those behaviors, but there's a reason why the student is moving towards those behaviors, and it's because their attention is shifting, and the little ones don't have a deep understanding of their own neurological functioning. You know, they're just trying to get the wiggles out is how I phrase it. Difficulty completing a request. Also the inability to follow through on a task. You know, these are all signs that there's something deeper going on.
So it's executive function. So their right. ability to execute on these tasks is being impaired as the vagal nerve is communicating with the body that there's right. a potential threat.
Yeah, yeah.
So you said facial color, muscle tension. What are those biomarkers too? Is that what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, if they have other somatic complaints, you know, like, oh, my tummy hurts or my head hurts or I'm dizzy, those kinds of things. Also, there are things that we can teach students to be aware of in themselves, right? Which is like my heart started to beat fast, right? That's a sign of arousal. My breathing has changed. That's a sign of arousal. I'm feeling tingly rushes throughout my body. I'm feeling a rush of heat somewhere. All of a sudden I'm hot and sweating.
So when you say arousal, does that mean that the vagus nerve has sort of turned on, or arousal means that the fight, flight, and freeze mechanisms are activating?
Yep, there's something in our environment that has gotten our attention that we are trying to evaluate whether this is a threat or this is exciting, or I should be running, or I should be engaging. And a lot of times that's a quick process for someone who has a highly functioning neurological system. For most people, you know, that's happening super quickly, so that we don't really have time to create awareness of or think about it. But in my work, through helping people understand the sensations of their body and what kind of all of that means and what to do with it, helps to kind of just create this bigger sense of awareness of how I am in relation to my environment.
Okay. So, and then in sort of wrapping up the part about the what to watch for, you said the color, different muscle tension, signals that they'll tell you that something is going on with them, like a tummy ache or tingling or what have you. And then you said, the heartbeat, they can do themselves, you said.
Yep.
But the breathing, they can notice themselves, but we can also notice the breathing. Can you tell us what an aroused breathing would look like versus a safe and social breathing?
Yeah. So a safe and social breath rate is often quiet. You know, it's not that full. We know that big sighs coming from students are often a neurological response to them starting to experience some difficulty. Big sighs, maybe they start breathing a little bit quicker. Or they stop breathing. Is often kind of part of that freeze response. And also teaching people to feel into their body sensations, whether that is I'm feeling a tingling or I'm feeling a hotness. And then there's also some mental stuff of just helping kids become more aware of, you know, their minds start to race, their thought process starts to kind of get out of control and not on topic. Those are all signs that like something in my environment has cued my arousal. And now I'm trying to navigate how I'm going to react to that.
Awesome. Such good stuff. It's so hard. Like the muscle stuff I see a lot with my kids. Like I'll be like, I noticed your shoulders just went up, and I'll do a lot of open-ended statements to them, sort of reflecting what I just saw, and then give them, you use the term holding space. I'll hold space for them to respond, to sort of take in what I just said and say, oh yeah, I'm thinking about this teacher that I'm frustrated with, or, you know, like I'll hold space. I notice that a lot. I'll notice the breathing a lot, but what I'm trying to think is like parents are watching and, you know, how did I develop the stuff that I do? I don't notice the skin color. Now I'm going to start really paying attention to that. But I guess, do you have any tips on how we can start noticing that? I guess first, we have to notice it in our, not first, but we have to notice it in ourselves too, which we don't a lot in our culture. And then we have to notice it in another human being. And I think for me, what I'm going to do is, maybe I'll put up a little sign in my office to remind me that just says, notice flush skin or something that like, so that I see it for a couple weeks until it's integrated in my habits in terms of communication. But do you have any tips for how a parent who's never really even thought about this can?
Yeah.
Am I jumping the gun here? Is this a good transition?
You know, that? No, yeah, that's a good transition. This is complex. There's a lot here. So the best way to manage the arousal response is to accept and acknowledge the experience via the felt sense of the body, right? And so
what does that mean? I know what you mean, but
yeah, when we're working with a kid and we notice some of those things, I want to tap in with that to what they're experiencing in their senses, right? So I don't necessarily need to always point out like, oh, I noticed your skin, all the color just left your face. Can you tell me more about that? You know, I was like, I'm noticing some changes in your body. Can you explain to me what you're feeling, right? Or are you, what are you feeling in your arms? What are you feeling? Can you tell me three things that you're feeling right now? And it's incredible how difficult it is for a lot of people to.
So let me give you an example from the other day, and you can unpack this some more. But I had a new student that I'm working with the other day. It was the first time I met with her. I met with her brother and then her. And I said, well, how does it feel when you're in that situation? She said, good. And I said, well, what does good feel like? Like, because she doesn't have languaging around to be like, well, my body feels relaxed or whatever. So, but you'll ask sort of leading questions to get into that. And you're saying it's really hard for us to describe that because of how to feel when that happened in the classroom. Bad.
Right. Well, and especially uncomfortable feelings because we're programmed by society to not feel discomfort. Right. And as an animal, all animals are evolutionarily programmed to avoid pain and seek pleasure. Mm-hmm. And so really what we want to do is acknowledge the felt experience, right? So discomfort might be my tummy is hurting, or I'm not comfortable in this chair, or it's quite variable from client to client. I'll just ask what's happening in your body.
Great.
Right. And then if they can't really access that, then we'll close our eyes and we'll go through a body scan, you know, and I'll say, can you feel your toes? You know, can you breathe into your toes? Can you move up into your legs and kind of go through the body and kind of ask them like, what does it feel like in that part of your body?
So for a parent now, just when you say, can you breathe into your toes? I just want to, for somebody who's never heard that before, I remember when I started doing yoga and they would say something about like that. It took me months to be like, what in the world does that mean? I do get it now.
Yeah.
But so Carly Rae is going to say some things that might sound kind of weird, but she doesn't mean imagine breathing into your toes, meaning like they have lungs. Can you kind of explain?
Yeah. So I guess from the physiological perspective, oxygen molecules enter our bloodstream via our lungs, well, via the blood. When we breathe, we're sending oxygen molecules into the lungs, into the bloodstream, and then those oxygen molecules are traveling all throughout the body. And it is kind of an imaginary process to think I'm sending my breath all the way into my toes, but it is also actually happening when we think about it from the level of oxygen molecules traveling through the bloodstream. And what I tell people is to breathe deep into their body so that they feel that part of their body whilst breathing, right? And so can you reach all the way into your toes with your breath? Can you feel your whole body expanding like a balloon and then contracting with your breath, you know? And so it's part creative visualization, it's part kind of guided meditation, but the baseline fix for, like, I don't really understand what you're talking about, what do? Just take a deep breath.
So to sort of bring it back in, the usefulness in what Carly's saying, and I'm going to unpack so much here for you parents, because this has been profound in my work with kids. But the usefulness in what she's saying, if you're sitting here saying, I'm just not sure why I'm going to take 10 minutes to talk to my kid about breathing into their toes. If you're feeling cynical, I'm sure there are some people who are. Look, here's what, and tell me what you think of this, Carly, but to me, the value in this is that what we're really doing is helping. There are many, many, many ways to do this. Carly mentioned it could be meditative, creative visualization, whatever word you use. There are many ways to do this, but the purpose of this is to become aware, to develop consciousness, to develop awareness, to develop mindfulness around the responses that the body has to different things, because we are not aware. And when we are not aware of what's going on and how it's impacting and influencing us, and we are not mindful but mindless and unaware and not conscious, then we are not making conscious, intentional decisions in our life. And that impacts executive function, of course, but it impacts our entire life. It impacts our relationships. It impacts our goals, being able to get into a career we love, being able to set proper boundaries for ourselves, being able to acknowledge our truth. And so I wanted to break this down, because what you're saying is so important, but I want to bring it back into why is she telling us that this is important? That's why.
Well, and we need to let those feelings run their course through our body.
The right? Discharge.
They need to reach their peak, they need to diminish, and then they need to resolve. Otherwise, it gets trapped in the body, and then that's trauma, right? And then we get stuck in those shutdown modes. Or, you know, I've come across a student before who's stuck in fight mode. You know, every response to everything is a fight. And not coming from a place of attitude, but coming from a place of, like, he really isn't feeling safe. And so no matter what the stimulus, he has to fight against it.
And he has not learned to access tools to discharge and to get into the safe and social.
Right. Yeah. And then we do also have, signs that resolution has been achieved. Trembling and shaking, vibrating, a feeling of warmth moving, a nice, full, slow breath is kind of that relief breath, that kind of, like, right? The relaxation of the muscles. And then oftentimes clients will experience just an overall feeling of relief, of getting to discharge that primed response.
Do you help them? And if you do, how do you help them to sort of connect the dots to have the awareness that that's happened? Are you reflecting it back to them or anything?
Yeah. So a lot of times, just again, checking in with what their experience of their felt sense of their body, what it actually feels like to be in the body. It's really incredible how different, people explain their felt sense of themselves. Sometimes it's with color. Sometimes it's, you know, I had a student the other day tell me it was like metal, like the way a fork scratches on the plate and makes that awful sound is what she was explaining the felt sense of her body to me. And so just constantly cueing, and I guess not constant, but continual, cueing them to just bring their awareness back into the felt sense. You know, okay, like, can you bring your awareness back into the feeling of the chair beneath you? You know, can you, I have a student who has really sensitive tactile functioning. His sense of touch is quite sensitive. And so we have just like a rabbit fur that he can put on his lap and he can stroke that rabbit fur. And as he gets dysregulated and as, you know, as we're challenging him to move through some of these exercises, this rabbit fur is his grounding place, right? Because he can feel it. It's soft, it's silky, and it keeps him back in his body, back in what he's actually sensing from his environment.
So this is so good. I want to tell parents again, if you're kind of listening and you're saying, well, like you just mentioned, cueing body awareness. I'm sorry if I'm misquoting you, but essentially you said you're often cueing what's coming back to. But for parents, if you're like, I don't know how to cue that. And she just said that about feeling the chair. That's a great idea. How would I think of that in the moment? Parents, you do not have to do this perfectly at all. Start the dialogue. I think the simple question, what are you noticing in your body? And holding space to really listen and not trying to answer for them. Because I can see a lot of adults trying to say, do you mean this? Really... And I'm a talker too. And that's one of my, I actually think I am good at it now, but that was one of my challenges, is to really hold that space and have wait time for a kid to describe the words. And my follow-up is tell me more, not, oh, do you mean this and that, but tell me more. But parents, just start the dialogue and do it for weeks and months. And you will notice, you'll be driving in the car, parents, and you'll notice, oh, I'm noticing my pinky toe on my left foot for some reason, you know, and you can go there. And as simple as that, as silly as that sounds, that is awareness that we sort of learn to start to generalize when something does go wrong and we notice we're really aggravated, we're having a real problem, we can then start to access the tools in a more meaningful way, even by practice when you're in the car and it's your pinky toe or the chair or the, so I just wanted to wrap that together just to tell the people how they can, I guess, implement some of this without feeling like they need to be at your level of expertise. And
right. I do want to kind of shift into some of those neurosensory systems and what they are and what they mean.
Cool. What's a neurosensory system?
So our sensory system, so the brain processes the ability to regulate sensory information and the demands of the environment. And so our sensory system basically is it's how we take in information from the environment, and how we do that is through our sense of balance, which comes from our vestibular system. And so our vestibular system is deep within the inner ear. It's this magical little alien looking machine, if you will, that helps us to feel balanced on the planet as it's whirling through space. It helps us with coordination. It is a baseline for all the other sensory functionings. A lot of times, this vestibular functioning. And so I always think about, you know, the circus trick of when all the guys get on one bicycle. Mm-hmm. And then there's one guy who's on the bike and the rest of the guys are kind of on that guy. That's the vestibular system. He's the guy on the bike. And so a lot of these higher level sensory functionings, so my olfactory or my sense of smell, my visual, my ability, not not yet my visual motor, but just my ability to input information that I'm seeing, my sense of hearing, my sense of taste, and my digestive system all have root to that vestibular functioning.
It's so funny because we think of the, like when I grew up, we were taught five senses, and I think there are seven vestibular, and is there one other one? Proprioceptory, is it?
Proprioception, yeah.
So, but I've never heard this before, and this is really cool for me, but you're saying that the vestibular, really, that one is so important to the other ones functioning properly.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
And so we, at the baseline, and I'll put a link to some of these, other resources in my resource packet. But the baseline is the central nervous system. So the brain and the spine. And then we move into our tactile sensations or what we feel on our skin, to our vestibular functioning, how we feel, balanced on the planet, and then proprioception, where we feel in relation to other objects in our environment. And then the next level up is sight, smell, hearing, taste. And then we move into the sensory motor stuff. So the awareness of our two sides of our body and how those two sides work together. And then we have motor planning. So, if you think like an obstacle course or playing on the jungle gym, there's a preemptive planning of what I'm going to do as I move through the monkey bars, right? Or what I'm going to do. And it's subconscious and conscious. And then we get into our reflex maturities and our ability to screen input. And then we move up to hand-eye coordination and ocular motor control. And so when I talk about ocular motor control, I'm talking about, can my eyes converge on one point? Can my left eye cross the midline over to the right and vice versa, which is needed in reading. Also the control of my iris and how it allows light to come into my eye. That all being then a baseline for my auditory language skill, my visual spatial perception, my affect or emotional center functioning. And then comes daily activities and behavior, and then comes executive functioning and academic learning, right? And so for us to see the system and that whole iceberg that's underneath the water of executive functioning, that there's a lot to kind of think about when we're assessing the difficulties of the student.
It's so overwhelming to even contemplate, I would think, as a parent saying, well, where do I even start?
Yeah.
And I think that one thing I want to mention now is you don't have to know all the things. And starting right. with body awareness and having dialogue around it is key, absolutely. And you don't have to be able to know everything that Carly Rae just said. But you have to know that there are things that are going on that are influencing and impacting executive function, behavior, and everything that's going on. And I want you to know that based on what Carly Rae said at the beginning, relationship, safe, healthy, securely attached, relating, and working on the relationship is so key in helping the nervous system be in that safe place so that these systems, because the way I'm hearing what you're saying is that they'll all developmentally sort of be at their own place. You might have certain kids that are in certain places developmentally with these and others, but your best chance of helping your kid developmentally develop these things as best they can is in safe and secure, healthy relating, learning what's going on in the body, having dialogue about that. And just starting to go down that path.
Yeah. So when our foundational systems are challenged, we naturally attend to our basic needs first, which are safety, security, and acceptance, right? And so when we're tending inward, our availability to tend outward diminishes. And so that's something that I really challenge teachers, to think about when we talk about the child who can't pay attention. I have such a problem with this idea of attention deficit. Judith Bluestone in the Handel Institute, they talk more about attentional priority, right? That like we're
because the attention is going somewhere.
Yeah, we're always attending to something. If we're not attending to anything, we're dead, right? Mm-hmm. And so rather than there being a deficit or a dysfunction in the attentional process, it's more just like the priorities have been miswired. And a lot of times, not even miswired, they're just in a different place. You know, the child that can't sit in their seat, he probably has a sensitive tactile experience of that hard plastic chair. We weren't designed to sit in hard plastic chairs for 40 hours a week. And so there's, you know, there's,
I'm
so
standing
many
right
things,
now.
Yeah. There's so many yeah. things about, the educational model and the learning expectations that we're placing on students that are not even considering whether or not they're feeling regulated to their environment, regulated to their own bodies, regulated to their emotions, you know, and so there's other things to think about, and there's really profound changes that can be made by addressing some of these other systems.
So I want to mention something that I do in my practice, and I was a teacher for 12 years, and just where I'm at philosophically and stuff. One of the things that I say a lot is that if I want a kid to learn, the number one thing that I have to do is help them feel safe in the environment. There has to be the healthy and safe and securely attached relating. They have to know that I'm a safe person. So, and I always say that the first 6 weeks of school really are about creating an environment where the whole class knows that I've got their back. Now, that's hard to do for teachers when you got 35 kids coming from all different experiences in life and all that. That is hard to do, and we do not honor that. We do not spend time on that. It's just get into the curriculum, 45 minutes, bell rang, go to your next class, sit in the plastic chair. And, you know, if you were to Google like learning child, you'd probably see images of kids in a chair with their hand up or a pencil. And like, is not the only thing that learned. But like you said, we have created this paradigm where that's what we imagine. But the first thing that I do in my practice is create the safety. I'm starting my school year in a couple weeks with my new students. I'm doing that relationship building and creating clear, consistent expectations at the beginning of the year. It's just everything. And I can't be teaching them the executive. I like the way that you put it, because I've never broken it down this much, but I do know enough to know that I can't be teaching executive function if I don't have the buy-in, and the buy-in comes from safety.
Yeah.
And knowing that I got their back. This guy, Seth, that I'm working with, this executive function coach, like, he's got my back. Yeah. It has to start there, and they have to know that they're safe. So I'm dealing in that social and safe. I could not have articulated it like that before today. Thank you. But that, and I think that that's so applicable to parents watching, and there are a lot of teachers who are going to be watching this too. So I think it's such a big thing, but it is not easy.
Well, and something else to think about for teachers is, you know, the ecosystem of the American family is also, you know, are they going home to a place where they're supported in and feeling safe and understand, you know, there's not a large amount of support for parents and understanding for parents. You know, there's a lot of people, just mom and dad and maybe just a single parent, like working 40, 60 hours a week just to pay the bills, you know, and their internal resources are tapped to begin with. And there's, I guess my my hope is for us to like zoom out from this and look at like the larger scale of like what we are as an ecosystem of like raising young humans in a modern society and how that, what that means for people and also just to really encourage parents that you're very, very brave to be raising a family in the 21st century and to just like give yourself compassion and a break, you know, that it is hard. It's hard and it's complex and there are resources.
So as we start getting to wrapping up, are there concepts or models or words or anything that you wanted to make sure that people walk away with?
Yeah, the polyvagal stuff is really, really brilliant. Justin Sinceri, like I said, in his polyvagal podcast, which is on Spotify and iTunes, he's distilled it down to really approachable language. They're about 30 minutes in length. And, you know, Stephen Porges and Peter Levine are brilliant doctors. And, you know, if you were to go pick up their books, they're a little bit dense. The Handel Institute, for anybody who thinks that they are seeing their child experiencing neurosensory dysfunctions, it's handel.org, handle.org. There are qualified assessors all over the country. And I have delivered a Handel program with a Handel. I'm not sure if it's master level Handel, but it is incredible. I can't speak to it enough. It's really brilliant work, and it's an alternative modality. It's not covered by insurance. But there's the woman who developed that, her name's Judith Bluestone, and she wrote a book called The Fabric of Autism. And it's really, it talks about kind of basic level Handel things in there. There's also just anything coming out of the Somatic Experiencing Institute, kind of helping people uncover themselves through understanding their felt sense of their body, and not so much emotional feelings, but actual sensation. Right now I've been sitting in a chair for over an hour and I have like a dull, achy feeling in my sits bones, that kind of stuff. That's what's coming to my mind right off the top of my head. I also will have a list of other kind of resources to do. And I think also just exercise, you know, like finding some sort of dynamic movement that your child is willing to engage in, whether that is a sport or dancing or walking, or playing, you know, getting them to be able to move their bodies and to discharge that stress response via that vigorous dynamic movement of the body is so vitally important. And one thing that is also coming to mind is the nutritional aspect of all of this, and that we have... coming out of the Cleveland Clinic, his name is slipping my mind in this very moment. Mark Hyman, I believe, is his name. He's a doctor out of the Cleveland Clinic. And he did a series called the Broken Brain series. And I think you can get the first episode of it for free, and then they want you to purchase the rest of them. But he is talking about some really, really cool stuff from the medical perspective, on how to address some of these more chronic issues that people are facing. And he kind of ties in most chronic disease in our culture today being a response to chronic inflammation in the gut and the brain. Mm-hmm. And he has a lot of information on lifestyle changes, how to diminish toxicity in our environment.
So much cool stuff coming out in the last few years about the gut biome and the impact of food or food-like substances and all these things that we are ingesting. Is it really nourishing us? And cool. So what specific action can parents take this coming week to start to implement some of your, some things as if you were like sitting with the parent one-on-one and you're like, all right, in the next week, here's something you can do to implement things that will help.
I think noticing if your child is feeling discomfort, to ask them, right? Can you tell me what's going on in your body? Oh, well, like maybe we should do this. Maybe we should flick our arms around and get the wiggles out, you know, like just, and really just cueing them to notice what's happening in their bodies. And then being able to also recognize when you're, as the adult, going to be moved from your center, right? Or not in that grounded, safe and social place yourself, to be able to honestly communicate with your child, to tell them that you're a human too, right? Of like, I'm feeling a little dysregulated, or I'm feeling cranky all of a sudden. Like I need to check in with myself to see what that feeling is all about. And also to be able to address conflict in that way, so that you can show up to that conflict with the child with your most grounded, best self, you know, and to really be able to say, like, I really want to find this resolve with you, and I need a moment to check in with myself before we can continue this conversation, because I want to make sure that I'm bringing my best self to the table so that we can have resolve. And then getting into some of these other resources, and knowing that there is an entire community of people out here in the world that have a willingness to support you guys and encourage you and can point you in direction of resources if you find yourself just kind of at a loss for what to do.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I have one more question for you.
Okay.
This is the last question of the whole thing. Before we get to that, is there anything that you left out that you want to make sure to?
Oh, I left out so much. I think we covered most of it.
Okay.
You know, there's going to be a lot of information in my resource.
I could talk to you for hours. Now, after I ask you my final question, I am going to ask you a nerd out question that I'll record for everybody.
Okay.
So if you are interested in hearing my next level question that I'm truly interested in, you can say you're the only person I've done this with, but so you guys can stay on and hear that last question. But I'm going to ask you my last interview question right now for those who want to get off the call after this. My last question to you is this: from your heart, Carly Rae, to theirs, the parent that's watching right now that's really concerned about their kid and their kid's executive function, their kid's potential for having a great future if they don't figure some things out. From your heart to theirs, what's the most important takeaway you hope people leave with right now?
I'm going to check in with my heart really quick. I'm just going to take a second. I think the most important takeaway is that there are other resources and there are other tools that are currently outside of the clinical model of assessing students in their functioning that do not pathologize behavior, and that there is, we can look at behavior through this lens of there's something happening in with my child, and this behavior is trying to tell me that. And because my child is not skilled in language or understanding their own neurosensory functioning, I have the ability to help strengthen or soothe this system with these alternative resources without pathologizing my child. Because all children are remarkable, and we are expecting them to adapt to a very complex, ever-changing world. And so you guys are doing it. You're crushing it. I give you many kudos, and lots of encouragement.
So good. So good. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Carly Rae. For those of you parents that need to get moving on, I'll see you in the next recording. Thank you all very much. And in a moment, I'm going to ask Carly my next level question. So thank you so much, Carly Rae.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, you ready for this?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm really interested in, I had like panic attacks and anxiety attacks after a coma and around 2000. And then I didn't want to take medication for it because the first doctor that I saw was like, get on such and such. I don't even remember what it was. And I was like, if I don't have to, I don't want to. So I got a therapist who couldn't prescribe medication. I didn't know who she was. I just knew she couldn't. So I went to her and she taught me mindfulness meditation. And she did EMDR with me. So I am very interested in EMDR, somatic experiencing, brain spotting, somatic therapy, somatic approaches, and things that I, in my mind, and I'm not a practitioner, and EFT tapping, and I am not an expert in this, but I have seen some, even things like art therapy, play therapy seem to me to be somatic therapies. Even journaling, handwriting the journal to me seems to be a somatic thing. And when you said vestibular as sort of the bottom bicycle of all the guys that, or bicycles that go up, that made me wonder, you know, how like EMDR, you might be doing this. They might be doing tapping or a vibrating thing in each hand from, you know, and it's sort of bilateral brain stuff. And when you said that about the vestibular, I wondered if you think that maybe some of, and some of the movement things or the brain gym, I know there's not a lot of evidence that shows that necessarily does much, but it certainly does enhance body mindfulness or body awareness doing that type of a thing. But do you think that the vestibular system might be underlying why a lot of the somatic things can be so helpful? And let me finish this thought. So to me, what seems to be happening is that when you're doing EMDR or something and you're in the sort of fight, flight, or freeze, and you want to get into the safe and social, and you're doing one of these therapies, to me, what seems to be happening is it's allowing you to discharge, because I think the amygdala in the brain is sort of saying, we aren't safe, we need to take care of it. And then you're doing something that's sort of like a pattern interrupt and maybe something with a vestibular system that's not supposed to be happening then. And the brain is saying, no, actually, we're okay. And the amygdala and the nervous system is going, no, we need to make sure. Are you sure we're okay? And it's going, yeah, we are okay. Are you sure? You said it learns very slowly, I think. And it's going, are you sure? Because it took me 3 years to sort of overcome the panic and anxiety. But so I guess with all that setup, do you think that the vestibular system is really key in that role? And am I even describing it in a useful way?
Yes. I want to actually look at my notes really quick because
so this is super nerdy. So for anyone who's still here, you must enjoy this type of stuff.
Because the vestibular system, is like a baseline functioning then for like muscle tone, both fine and gross. And so, like,
it's a what?
Fine being like rolling a booger, gross right. being like yeah. moving, you right? And then including the eye muscles and the tongue and the jaw control, right? It has to do with our balance and our proprioception. And so it directly and indirectly kind of regulates all the other sensory systems above it. So then we have our vestibulocerebral projections, right? Which is a lot of motor control stuff that then like talks to the cerebellum, which is, you know, essentially the autonomic nervous system. But what is interesting that I immediately thought of what Peter Levine talks about renegotiation so there's a traumatic event and you don't have the opportunity to discharge that physiological priming that has happened that is natural. And so then you come out of that coma and then you have anxiety, you have panic attacks, you have this, right? Because, and I hope I'm speaking about this correctly, but my understanding of it is that because that initial like, oh my God, I'm gonna die, got trapped somewhere physiologically exactly. in the body. And so that comes out the other side as panic and anxiety. And so what Peter Levine talks about in his book, Waking the Tiger, which I think you would really love.
I have that and I've listened to it multiple times.
Oh, great. So he talks about that idea of renegotiation, where you kind of move through that process and in kind of a creative visualization sort of way, allow yourself to run, allow yourself to fight, allow yourself to renegotiate that whole scenario in a way that allows your system to discharge that response appropriately.
Okay. I think the number one thing for me in that process of retraining it with the discharge was meditation.
Yeah.
But was not meditation for the purpose of relaxation, which I think a lot of people miss this point. I would meditate in anxiety.
Yeah.
And I would notice what was going on somatically, which was terrifying.
Yeah.
I was supposed to pay attention to the breath. And my coma was because I wasn't breathing. My lungs were filled with fluid. So it was terrifying for me to pay attention to the breath when the breath was the thing that felt like I was going to die. But that is the thing that I think the meditating on and noticing, well, what does it feel like to be afraid that I'm going to suffocate when I'm not going to suffocate?
Right. Well, and that's actually some of the critique coming out of the academic world of this like mindfulness movement and how it's this idea of like, oh, the whole world could be burning down, but I'm mindful, so I'm not moved from my center. And that's actually a departure from what it actually is, from what meditation actually is.
So like, glad that critique is coming out because
yeah, me too. You know,
that's my experience.
They're talking about like spiritual bypassing and all of these words that are constructed around the critiques of it. But as you get deeper into some of like the Buddhist teachings, it's not as a mechanism of escaping those feelings. It's you need to sit in it. You need to sit in that fear and you need to sit in that discomfort, and then it peaks and then it resolves. Right. And then you're still alive.
And I feel like avoidance is like we keep getting close to the peak, but we never allow it to get to resolution because we avoid. We'll smoke cigarettes or do drugs or do gaming or whatever the mechanism is for avoidance. I feel like we get up to it and
and
we want to feel that and know we're going to be okay feeling uncomfortable. Yeah. It's just. But that is terrifying.
Back to co-regulation, right? If you have a person with you who can stay in their center while you move through all of that, that's super profound. That's quite therapeutic. You know, like there, if there's someone who can hold your hand and stroke your arm and tell you, like, I know this is uncomfortable. I know that you're afraid. I'm here. I'm holding this space for you. We're just going to let this move through. And And if it doesn't kind of move through naturally on its own, then what can we do? Can you make a little noise? Can you vibrate your throat for me? Do you feel like you need to yell? That we get into like the primal scream therapies and those kinds of things. You know, do you need to flap your wings? Do you need to shake and gyrate? Do you need to envision that you're running away from that lion? You know, all of these tools are helping us to access discharging that stress response, and yeah, it's incredible the rate at which we avoid discomfort, and also the profound experience of being able to move through that discomfort whilst being witnessed is really, really potent stuff, really beautiful.
I'm absolutely in alignment with that statement from my experiences too. What do you think about the, how are you doing time-wise? Is it okay for me to ask you another nerdy question? So what do you think about the idea that music therapy or play therapy or even journaling and the fine motor in that, or even rock climbing? You said something about exercise before, but rock climbing and the gross and fine motor skills that are required for that, or mountain biking, or all, you know, we have formal therapies, right? Yep. Or formal somatic therapies, but can there be a somatic discharging experience through those things as well?
Absolutely. And those also ignite our like play centers, right? And so in some of the polyvagal theory stuff, play is actually the safe and social and the fight response working together.
Being on a roller coaster, and for someone who actually enjoys a roller coaster?
Yeah. Or, you know, if you think about like your basic, just like wrestling, you know, like little kids wrestling,
it's or play wrestling and dog,
right. Yeah. And so we're coupling safe and social with that, with the physiological priming of moving our limbs. Right. And so I think all of those things, and you also couple that with enjoyment, right? Like, rock climbing, someone might find rock climbing 1,000 times more enjoyable than running on the treadmill. Right. And you have, rock climbing is such an amazing, experience, because there is that excitement and that like I could fall, right? Like a rock could come loose, and, you know, and that thrill. So you're really moving through all of, that arousal process in doing something like rock climbing. And I think any activity that a person is willing to engage in that allows them to move dynamically, to use both left and right sides of their bodies together, it's going to be beneficial always.
All right. Carly Rae, thanks so much.
Yeah.
That was awesome. I love talking about this stuff clearly. I don't know a lot, but like I've been exposed to enough that I am starting to see these sort of similar patterns in all these different therapies. And my brain is always like, well, what can I, how can I sort of meld the models and theories and stuff together to get the most applicable guidance to my families so that they can process stuff? And
I mean, ultimately, encourage them to find what resonates with them, what they are connecting with. Because I tell my clients all the time, all streams lead to the same oceans.
And that's, I think, why it's so confusing, is because, like, as you talk, you've mentioned so many theorists that might be different streams leading to the same thing. But we're looking for, like, what's the panacea? What's right. The one? You know, and it's not like that.
Yeah,
like,
I don't think
do something, anything, families, kids, like do, like start going down the rabbit holes, and you will find solutions.
Yeah, yeah. And
but the fear of going there. What's that?
Yeah, I was gonna say, and whatever you believe, so make it your truth.
I hear you. I was thinking if you're going to say more about that.
That's a pretty complex thought too.
Well, thank you again. Thank you so much. I'm going to stop the recording here. You can stay on with me for a minute, but thank you all. If you hung out for this, I'm sure you enjoyed that because you wouldn't have if you didn't. So good luck, families. We'll see you soon.